Candy from Strangers by Mark Coggins is original, smart, and good to the last page, says best-selling author and executive producer of the hit TV series Bosch, Michael Connelly. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 7. They eat horses, don't they? Shouldering the high expectations of both the Stockwells was something I hadn't planned on. Later that night, I sought guidance for the task in Sri Atmanidhi's Golden Dawn of the New Epiphany, thumbing through the book while I imbibed a glass or three of Maker's Mark bourbon and listened to Miles Davis' The Birth of the Cool. The best advice Needy had for me was, once on the back of a bounding tiger, it's hard to alight. But my biggest insight was a realization that the title of the book sounded a lot like Dawning of the Age of Aquarius. I suspected that a lot of the other new epiphanies in Golden Dawn were repackaged from other sources, too. The next morning, I went back to the office to finish a report for another case and pick up something I had promised to deliver to an old friend. The report wrapped up my investigation of a fellow musician who had been on temporary disability for 8 months with acute carpal tunnel syndrome, developed, he claimed, as a result of his duties as a software tester. His employer had gotten fed up paying the disability benefits and had hired me to look into it. Once I found out that one of the symptoms of carpal tunnel is an inability to bring the thumb into opposition with the other fingers, and that he was a flat picker in a bluegrass band, all I had to do to nail him was attend one of his gigs and videotape the session. When I called Gretchen in to type up my scribbles, she skimmed through the report and asked me how in the world I could give up one of my own. I was all set to let him go until he sped up the tempo like a runaway train during one of his solos, I said. Then he was a dead man. You bass players are a vindictive lot, she said, and went out with a flip of her hair. I retrieved the item I was delivering from the office safe and then hailed a cab on Market Street to take it to my friend's place on Russian Hill. There was no point in getting the Galaxy out of the garage, because with the possible exception of the marina, there wasn't a worse place to park in San Francisco, particularly when the person you were visiting lived on Lombard, near the bottom of what souvenir postcards proclaimed to be the crookedest street in the world. I exited the cab at Lombard and Leavenworth amidst a tourist expeditionary force of multiple nationalities. Standing at the forefront, shock troops from Japan aimed digital video cameras at the parade of cars coming down 8 cobblestone switchbacks in the 40-degree slope from Hyde Street. Behind them stood Germans, dressed in khaki shorts and odd-looking sandals despite the cold weather, providing supporting fire with their Leicas. Overweight Americans, too diffident or lazy to claw their way to the front lines, brought up the rear, munching on corn dogs and taking the occasional pot shot with disposable cameras. I threaded my way through the tourists and went further down Lombard Street, past number 953, which played host to MTV's infamous Real World show, and up to the door of a modest Victorian that had been segmented into 3 condominiums. I rang the buzzer for the flat on the ground floor, and the door was opened almost immediately by an old black woman wearing a loose-fitting polka-dot dress and matching polka-dot hairband. Her limbs were thin and bony and riddled with twisted varicose veins, but she smiled when she saw me, and 20 years dropped from her face.
"August," she said, "you little villain."
She took hold of my cheek with a bent, arthritic hand and pinched for all she was worth.
"You've lost weight. What in the world have you been doing with yourself?"
The right answer was recovering from being beat to within an inch of my life on the misadventure with the venture capitalist, but there was no way I was going to cop to that.
"Ouch, Hilma, don't pinch off any more."
I tugged her hand away from my face. "I've forsworn all animal products and become a vegan. This is the new healthy me."
"Sounds like the new cracks, you."
Hilma turned to walk back into the house, leaving me to close the door.
"Besides which," she called over her shoulder, No soybeans died for those wingtips. They look like cowhide to me.
I followed her down a short hall to the living room. It's only a temporary situation, I said. I've got hemp moccasins on order. The old black man reclining in the leather barca lounger in the middle of the room grinned big. His left pant leg was empty from the knee down, and a shiny black prosthesis, dressed in a black wingtip of its own, was resting against a chair.
"What are you babbling about now, boy?" he asked. "Did you bring my medal?"
I held up the gold plaque-mounted medal that had brought from downtown. The inscription said the medal came from the president's office of San Francisco State University and was awarded to Victor Lane, Dean of Jazz, for his long-standing, widespread contributions to SFSU and the city of San Francisco. Since Victor had been too ill to attend the award ceremony, he had asked me to go in his place and give his acceptance speech. I passed the plaque over to him, and he beamed down at it.
Ain't that fine?
I don't know where you're going to put it, said Helma,
who had settled herself onto the plaid sofa.
There isn't a square inch of wall that isn't covered with a picture or a medal or a playbill or some damn thing.
I knew without checking that she was right. Victor had been a fixture in San Francisco's jazz scene since the 1930s and had played bass with Basie, Ellington, and Gillespie, among many others. He had autographed pictures from all of them, and as I glanced across to the fireplace mantel, I could see a photo of Billie Holiday adorned with a still bright red lipstick kiss. Holiday had written, "Lover man, oh where can you be?" beside it.
"We'll find a place for it," said Victor and looked up to eye me skeptically. "I suppose you ruined my speech."
"How could I ruin it? I told them they could all kiss your ass, just like you said." Victor laughed and leaned down to pick up his artificial leg. He waggled a foot in my direction.
"Not my ass," he said. "My big toe."
Guess I didn't bring the right props. Hilma stood up with a grunt and snatched the leg out of his hands.
"It's bad enough you won't wear the damn thing, Victor, but I will not have you roughhousing with it in the living room."
She returned it to its place beside Victor's chair.
"And you know he ruined Thanksgiving at our daughter's house. Use the damn leg to bat dinner rolls across a table."
Victor winked at me. He'd been a big man once, over 6 feet and nearly 200 pounds. But time and a medical almanac of diseases had shrunken to the point where a wink made him look like a naughty elf.
"Lucky I didn't end up with a broken bat single," he said, "the way Martha cooks."
"Hush up," hissed Hilma. "You want anything while I'm up, August? Tea, coffee, or something stronger?"
"No, thanks. I should be..."
"I know what he wants," Victor put in. "He wants to play the bass."
He was right. I always wanted to play the bass when I came to Victor's. He had two, an old one which he called Baby, and a new one that he purchased as a backup. Baby had been with him for 7 decades, and he played it everywhere and with everyone. Scratched and worn in many places, and probably quite inferior in tone, Baby was Victor's link to the heyday of San Francisco jazz, and no one was touching it but him. The backup bass, on the other hand, had no such heritage and was okay for friends to play. This was somewhat ironic, as it was a beautiful instrument, crafted in Italy by the famous maker Alberto Beglomini, and was worth about 10 times as much as Baby. Victor had made a number of half-hearted attempts to sell the Beglomini bass over the years, and it was one such attempt that first brought me into contact with him. Even though the $30,000 price tag was well out of my league, I'd come by the house one day to kick the tires, and ended up not with a bass, but with a good friend instead. Since my own bass had been destroyed in a brawl with some bad guys, playing the Beglomini was still a great treat during visits, and it was a standing joke between us that I would always try to negotiate Victor down from the $30,000, but neither of us took it seriously. I said, "I might be persuaded to give it a try."
"Persuaded my ass," said Victor. "You've been stealing glances at it since you walked in the door. Go ahead. That's why Hilma took it out of the case."
The bass was on a stand next to the fireplace. I lifted it out carefully and took it to the center of the room. Someone once said that the perfect bass is like a tailored suit of clothes, good to look at and easy to wear. Victor's bass almost certainly fit the bill. The flamed Italian poplar gleamed invitingly. The Roman god Jupiter carved on the scroll was empowering, and the ebony fretboard felt just right under my fingers. My only complaint stemmed from the fact that I was taller than Victor, so the end pin on the bottom was not as long as I would have liked. Hunching over slightly, I began to play the first thing that came to mind, a solo from French bassist Guy Pedersen. I had been listening to Stefan Grappelli records from the 1960s, and Pedersen's solo on one of the tunes had stuck. Victor nodded his head in time to the music.
Pretty good for a white boy, but I don't recognize the tune.
If I sounded good, it was more to do with the bass than me. It had a huge, deep-sounding low end, a ton of sustain, and a great upper register. Grappelli, I said, reaching down the fret for a high note. Guy Pedersen solo.
A Frenchman, said Hilma, surprised. She always had a soft spot for the French. What does a no-account like you know about the French?
I finished the measure and straightened up. They eat horses, don't they?
Very funny. Victor and I went to Paris once, stayed at the Ritz and everything. They gave Victor another damn medal, the Order of Arts and Letters or something.
Victor laughed.
That's right, me and Jerry Lewis. But this one means a lot more.
He hefted the SFSU plaque, then watched as I returned the bass to the stand.
Well, August, what do you think?
I rubbed a smudge off the gleaming poplar. I'll take it, assuming you have a 10-year layaway. Victor gave a bittersweet smile and shook his head.
Sorry, boy. I don't think I've got a 10-year anything.
I kicked myself on the cab ride back for bringing up anything to do with age. Victor was philosophical about his situation, but his recent bout with peripheral vascular disease had cost him his leg, and I knew that mortality was weighing heavier on his mind than ever before. I paid the cabbie off in front of the Turk Street garage. I woke the galaxy from a fitful sleep, then pointed it south to the neighborhood of Noe Valley. It was time to check out Carolyn Stockwell's place of employment. Originally home to working-class immigrants, Noe Valley had evolved into a 21st-century enclave for internet geeks, dog walkers, luthiers, aromatherapists, AIDS activists, lawyers, doctors, documentary filmmakers, organic farmers, and lesbian moms. The main drag through the district was 24th Street, and judging from the people and paraphernalia and evidence that day, you couldn't fling a mango smoothie from your SUV without splattering a passing golden retriever, a baby in a stroller, or a rolled yoga mat. You might have also nailed an Earth First petition ghoulie. I orbited in a 3-block radius for about 10 minutes until I found a parking spot big enough for the galaxy. Unfortunately, it was in a yellow loading zone in front of the health foods market. Since there was a sign explicitly forbidding all but those with store business to park there, I put a scrap of cardboard with a scrawled tofu salesman in the car window. I almost wrote traveling tofu salesman, but I figured that was pushing it. The Noe Valley rendition of Starbucks was a partially converted Victorian with retail on the bottom and 3 floors of apartment above. Not counting the Irish setter and the Rottweiler panning by the door, there were 2 benches worth of khaki and fleece-clad patrons out front. Inside, the preference for khaki and fleece was maintained and even amplified, including 1 stroller-bound infant dressed in a hooded fleece jumper. It struck me that there was nothing more all-American than swaddling your child from head to foot in a substance made from recycled 6-pack rings. Most of the tables were taken by 20 and 30-somethings enjoying a late breakfast while chatting, highlighting textbooks with yellow markers, reading the newspaper, or working on computers. A second infant could be seen breastfeeding in the lap of its young mother as she sat on a bench by the window. Since Mom herself was sucking a strawberry deep in a venti mocha frappuccino, it was difficult not to have thoughts about cutting out the middleman, or woman. I went up to the counter where 2 of the baristas were in the midst of a conversation. The first was a Chinese girl with bangs so long she was constantly blinking to keep the hair from her eyes. I went to Modesto for the weekend, she said, and I stopped in at the local Starbucks for a laugh. How was it? Asked her compatriot, a reedy, fair-skinned kid with a blue bandana covering dreadlocks like coils of Spanish moss. You wouldn't believe it. They're such hicks down there. They don't even know to call decaf first on the orders. Oh my God, was a breathy response. I decided to stick my beak in before they went off on the way Modesto steamed the milk. Excuse me, I'd like to speak to the manager. The Chinese girl came up to the register, still glowing from her crack about the yokels in Modesto. And how do you know I'm not the manager? because I'm guessing the manager doesn't refer to the business as Starfucks. The glow faded and she blinked her eyes all the more furiously. It's not because... I mean, you don't want to see him because of that, do you? No, it's about something else entirely. The kid with the dreadlocks came around from behind the espresso machine. His expression, too, was suddenly downcast and serious. The manager's on his break, he said. He should be back in about 10 minutes if you'd like to wait. Or you could leave your number. I told him I'd wait and ordered a cup of plain black coffee, without any Indian spices or soy additives, and took it over to the last open table in the place. I sipped my coffee and let my glance wander around the room. A couple to my right were trading barbs across a demilitarized zone of newspapers held at reading height. "Take this so-called advantage in spatial reasoning," she said tartly. "That's just another bullshit argument to stop women from advancing in the workforce. I mean, what the hell is spatial reasoning anyway?" The man poked his head over the sports page. One definition might be knowing which way to curb your tires on a hill. She threw down the real estate section. "I told you not to bring that up anymore. The hydrant stopped it before it got half a block." The table in front of me was host to two young women with a pile of books and backpacks large enough to provision an assault on Everest. The blonde, who sported a multicolored Peruvian beanie and polished fingernails of at least three other colors, looked up from her dog-eared copy of The Great Gatsby. "Do you know what I just realized? Zelda Fitzgerald was a Yoko Ono of the 1920s. Her brunette companion paused with her highlighter mid-paragraph to give this thought due consideration. "But Yoko broke up the Beatles. Who did Zelda break up?" "Her husband, of course. Remember he wrote that essay, The Crack-Up?" "Oh, yeah. She also broke up Hemingway and Fitzgerald." The blonde snapped her fingers. "That's right. She called them fairies. But you'd have to say Yoko Ono was a Zelda Fitzgerald of the 1970s. Zelda came first." This seemed to ruin it for the blonde. "I suppose," she said listlessly. "It sounded better the other way, though." I made eye contact with a fleece baby who was parked in a stroller several tables over. I raised my cup in a silent toast, and he responded with a frothy saliva bubble. This seemed to be the most profound thing to come out of anyone's mouth since I had walked in the door. I downed the rest of my coffee, and still lacking anything in the way of managerial presence, turned to examine the community art exhibit hanging on the wall behind me. I realized with a mild jolt that the photographs were similar to those I had seen in Carolyn's room. I stood up to get a closer look and confirmed her cramped signature on a gritty, black-and-white photo of a woman's navel pierced with a silver stud. "Self-Portrait," it was titled. "How do you like the artwork?" said a voice behind me. I turned to find a tall, well-muscled guy with fair skin and very short blonde hair. He had a way of making even the green Starbucks apron look snappy, and I guessed that Chris Duckworth would be pleased to make his acquaintance. "Oh, it's a little recherché for me," I said. He smiled. "Yeah, I saw that in this morning's Word of Day column, too. You're one up on me. I haven't managed to work it into a sentence yet." He held out his hand. "I'm Dave Sands, the manager here. Leah said you wanted to talk to me." "I'm actually here about the artist." I nodded at the photographs. "I understand she works here." Sands got the sort of look of mild strain you get when you want to be polite, but are worried about where the conversation is headed. "Yes, she works here. She hasn't been in for a while, though." "I know. She's gone missing." He watched with increasing strain as I pulled out my wallet and showed him my investigator's license. "I've been hired by the family to find her," I said. "I'd appreciate it if you would spare me a few minutes of your time." Sands started to say something, then stopped himself. He ran his hand through his hair. "Okay," he said finally. "You got somewhere where we can talk?" "This is it, unless you want to sit on coffee bags in the storeroom." I gestured at the table I'd come from and returned to my seat. "You knew that she was missing, right?" Sands settled into the chair across from me and glanced around the store a little nervously. "Yes, someone called, but I didn't know whether to believe him. He sounded drunk. At first I thought he said he was her father, and then I thought he said he was the police. To tell you the truth, I wasn't sure if I should have talked to him about Carolyn, and I'm not sure," his voice trailed off, "if he should talk to me either." He nodded. "I realize it seems odd, but it's all on the level. Her father is a police detective. He's been hitting the bottle pretty hard since you went, so it's very likely he was drunk when he spoke to you. Sands twisted his mouth into a dissatisfied pout. But if he's with the police, why would he hire someone to look for her? It's a long story. The short version is he's burned a lot of bridges. If you're still concerned about talking to me, you're welcome to call her mother and get confirmation. Sands glanced at his watch and then crossed his arms. He gave me a level stare. No, that's okay. I don't have anything earth-shattering to tell you anyway. I was just being cautious. All right, maybe you could start by telling me about her last day at work. When was that? Do you recall? It was September 24th, a Wednesday. I know because I had to cover for her on the 25th, and after that we put someone else in her spot in the staff rotation. But as for the day itself, there was nothing special. On Wednesday she worked a full shift. She came in at 8:30 and worked to 5:30, just like usual. She didn't mention anything about missing the next day. Did she say if she was going somewhere that evening? Not to me. If I had to guess, I'd say she went out with her friend Monica. Monica often met her after work on Wednesdays. But you didn't actually see Monica that evening. Sands unfolded his arms and reoriented the watch on his wrist. I noticed for the first time that it was a silver Oyster Rolex. Are you in a hurry? I asked. He flashed a perfect smile of blinding white teeth. No, I mean I'm a little, but I just got the watch as a gift and I can't stop looking at it. Nice gift. Yes, it is. He pulled his shirt sleeve over the watch self-consciously. To answer your question, no, I don't remember seeing Monica. I might have been in the back when Carolyn left, though. Did anyone else ever meet her after work? A boyfriend, say? Sands looked up to the ceiling to think for a moment, then shook his head. No, I don't recall anyone else coming in to meet her. How about here at work? Did she have any friends on the staff? If I'm honest, I have to say no. Carolyn's a bit of a loner. She always took her breaks by herself, usually to walk up and down 24th Street snapping photos. I was probably as close to her as anyone in the store, and that's not saying much. I looked over to the fleece baby, who obliged me by blowing another bubble. Sands was right. He wasn't telling me anything earth-shattering. Did she seem out of sorts in any way during the period before she left, I asked? Complain of any problems in her personal life? No, she was actually very upbeat. She was excited to finally get her turn at the exhibit wall and was pleased by the response she got when she hung her photos. I caught her a number of times just staring at people while they admired them. Since most people in the store didn't know she was the artist, it was kind of a voyeuristic thrill for her. A strident beeping began at the back of the store, behind the register. Sands looked up in annoyance. From the flashing lights that accompanied the noise, it was apparent that one of the coffee brewers needed attention, but both of the baristas were busy with customers. Are we done here? Asked Sands. I really need to get that. Sure, I said. We're done. Sands jumped up and ran behind the counter to deal with the alarm. I lingered a moment at the table and then went back to the photo exhibit. I found an artist statement tacked up in one corner by the stand with the coffee stirrers and cream and was plowing through the turgid prose, which included quotes from Plato, Carl Jung, and the obligatory reference to Joseph Campbell, when Sands' voice interrupted me from behind once more. Say, Mr. Reardon, was it? If you're going to Carolyn's house, can you deliver these for me? There's no room for them in the back, and she really shouldn't have sent them here anyway. When I turned, he pressed an armful of Amazon.com boxes into my chest. I grabbed at them, but one of the smaller ones dropped off the pile and fell to the floor. Sands bent to pick it up and stacked it on top once more. There you go, he said with more than a trace of satisfaction. I'll hold the door open for you. Apparently, if I didn't want to become a human merchandise display rack, this was my cue to leave the store. I trudged after him, threading a careful path through the tables and strollers and giving the fleece baby a final wink as I passed. Thanks for taking these off my hands, he said as he twisted the doorknob. And good luck finding Carolyn. Tell her I'll be happy to hire her back when she returns. But what if she's not returning? Sands fogged the crystal of his Rolex with his breath and polished it with his sleeve. Oh, I've got a feeling about that. I think she's just taking a little sabbatical.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Candy from Strangers, a book Mystery Scene Magazine described as crackling and whip smart. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.